Please silence all electronic devices.
Lawsuits, lie detectors, and the drunk driving video. This week in North Carolina politics.
I believe that Republican House leaders have consistently lied for 2 weeks. If they still dispute this, I would challenge their leadership to take a lie detector test.
Look, this isn't the Maury Povich Show, okay? This is state government. That's just a sideshow, and I'm not...
Any further discussion or debate?
From the 4th Estate Bunker on West Jones Street in downtown Raleigh, you're queued up to the WUNC Politics Podcast as we do each Friday a review of some of the stories that were on the move this week. Rob Schofield from the Progressive NC Policy Watch is here, as too is Becky Gray from the conservative John Locke Foundation here to review some of the happenings.
Hey, guys. Thanks. Nice to see you.
The latest legal challenge to North Carolina political maps has been filed in state court. The claim is that the state's 13 congressional districts, U.S. House seats, are extreme partisan gerrymanders and violate the state constitution. There is a plaintiff for each district. The suit is being funded by the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, a political action committee formed by President Obama and former Attorney General Eric Holder. Supporters of the suit say the recent ruling striking down state legislative maps provides them with a strong case. Makes sense.
I think so. I mean, they have to be aware this is going to make it illegal for Democrats to gerrymander, as it should. It should be an independent process. Obviously, we've had some confidence that we were going to be moving forward with respect to the state legislative districts. We've already got a court ruling there and an order to the General Assembly to come up with fair maps. There's absolutely no reason we shouldn't do that with congressional maps. We know that it's an evenly divided state, and it's hopelessly gerrymandered. It's a 10-3 Republican majority exclusively because we've drawn maps to guarantee that.
I think because of the latest state court decision of the 3-judge panel that we're still looking at with those legislative maps, there is some thought that, well, if there was too much partisan consideration for the legislative maps, then perhaps there was for the congressional maps as well. I think that's where this is coming from, right on the heels of that. I was a little bit surprised on the timing. I thought that maybe we would wait until that decision, the legislative state court thing kind of played out a little bit more. I also think it's interesting that Eric Holder and the National Democratic group that I understand is very well funded is putting these efforts into North Carolina, which tells you, I think, how important we are as a, not only a state, but how we play in the whole political landscape.
Rob, I think of you as an idealist. Ideally,
thank you, Jeff.
Wouldn't this challenge and subsequently other challenges be better and perhaps more unifying on the back end if they came from less political actors?
You know, I mean, the law is what the law is. The plaintiffs have a right to bring their lawsuit. Maybe it would be look better in the media if it were brought by a nonpartisan group. But the effect is the same. I assume, I haven't read what they've said, but I'm assuming that the group that's filed this are making the admission that Democrats do this too. It's what happened in Maryland. It's why we had a case before the U.S. Supreme Court about the gerrymandered districts in Maryland. There's got to be an admission that this is being done by both parties, and that's the objective ultimately here, is to get fair maps that do not favor either side. And if either side is willing to take that position, Republicans, Democrats, Libertarians, whoever, welcome to the team. We need to be moving forward with that. I'm glad that they've come to this conclusion. Maybe they wouldn't several years ago, but happily they've come to this conclusion.
Jeff, to your point of, you know, is this the smartest thing, having a strong Democratic partisan group interject themselves into this and file this lawsuit? One thing, unintended consequence or intended consequence, I don't know, but, you know, it's no secret, and we've talked about this the last several weeks, that, you know, things are very contentious here at the General Assembly. Does this further divide? Does it fuel that fire that we're already seeing? One of the things that we've talked about before is redistricting reform, and I think Rob and I have agreed consistently that we need to look at redistricting reform. I have concerns about what this is going to do to those efforts during this session. You know, things are just so contentious, so hot. I don't know what this filing this lawsuit is going to do to the current situation we have. The other quick point on it, too, is the timing of it. As I understand it, I haven't looked at the lawsuit yet. It was just filed. But this would affect the 2020 maps That filing date is coming up in December. Do we have time to do something with this that it would have an impact?
We are 67 days away from candidate filing as we chat here on a Friday. I believe that we could draw a little bit of a presumption here. In the state case, judges reserve the right to move
right.
the primary schedule, which would include candidate filing, which would include everything. I mean,
right.
just 3 years ago, 2016, we had a second primary. Some listeners may remember, for congressional seats. We could have a primary, I believe, based on what the state constitution allows for as late as September next
sure.
year.
I mean, we're 14 months away from the election. We have an election every 2 years. If we're going to have to file a lawsuit at the very beginning of the two-year biennium, that's a pretty limiting rule. I mean, there's plenty of time to get – if this moves forward. And it's worth remembering that the decision that was issued by the three-judge panel in the state map case was bipartisan. We had Republican and Democratic judges. The same thing could happen here. We could have a – you know, hopefully we'll have a bipartisan ruling that we need to do away with partisan gerrymandering for our congressional districts as well.
The CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield is out. Patrick Conway was arrested for drunk driving in June. His two young daughters were in the car. Video was published by news organizations this week. In the video, Conway is swerving on I-85, then collides with a tractor trailer. Fortunately, no injuries were reported. In the aftermath, three states are now investigating if Blue Cross failed to properly disclose the incident to insurance regulators. What is or was the rationale for keeping Conway employed for 3 months until this thing blew up publicly?
I don't know. I mean, we're still learning about this. According to the reports, Blue Cross Blue Shield was aware of it. The Board of Trustees was aware of it. They did an investigation and a study, were able to determine, at least in their view, of a course of action. You know, we have to remember, Blue Cross Blue Shield is a private company. You know, I was a little bit surprised when the insurance commissioner, Mike Causey, really early on in this came out with a pretty strong statement. But, you know, as this thing has played out, I think, Jeff, you mentioned his two young daughters being in the car. You know, there's questions of judgment. There's questions of lots of things. And, of course, he has resigned just in the last day or two since all of this has come to the forefront.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly an inexcusable behavior. You know, I think it's important to keep in mind, Blue Cross isn't just your run-of-the-mill insurance company. They have a special role in North Carolina. They were created essentially, they're a nonprofit, they were created as essentially a public trust. We got into this debate in great detail several years ago when there was a move to convert Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina into a for-profit entity, and the legislature ultimately said, heck no. And it was because of that. It's viewed as being a real a state treasure, if you will, that provides an essential service for our citizens. And so there's, I think, even a higher standard to be expected, and I'm glad to see the board of directors took it seriously. They say that they didn't have all the access to all of the behavior that he engaged in after the arrest, which is pretty amazing when you read the details of it. Maybe that was
threatening a highway trooper and saying, I'm going to call the governor and the governor's going to get you in trouble.
Yeah, well, I mean, and just being incredibly belligerent and just clearly a very troubled man who's got a problem. And so, I mean, it's a very sad development for him. But clearly they had no choice but to move forward.
Blue Cross has hundreds of thousands of state employees and really serves millions of people in North Carolina. So we'll leave that there for now. Perhaps more to come on that in the weeks and months to come. Let's turn our attention to the UNC system, where turmoil seems to be the real only point of consistency these days. On Tuesday, Chairman of the Board of Governors, Harry Smith, announced he would step down within a week. A day later, UNC system interim president Bill Roper announced that he no longer wants the job permanently and will leave in June. Becky, do you have any optimism that the leadership of the UNC Board of Governors is going to find some level of stability in the coming weeks and months? And if you do, why?
Yeah, I really do, because I think a couple things. First, Jeff, you mentioned that this has been a sense of turmoil, sort of turmoil central, if you will, this UNC system for a number of years. I think we need to get back to some stability. I think we need to get a strong leadership and a united board of governors. This is a movement towards that. Harry Smith stepping down as chairman, I think, is the right move. He's been a very contentious leader through this. Bill Roper announcing his retirement in June gives the search committee time to find a good replacement. replacement and kind of pushes them along, which I think is healthy, and I think that's the way that we should go about it. I have tremendous confidence. I have tremendous trust in the UNC system. It has clearly, through decades, has been a crown jewel in everything that we have to offer for North Carolina. And I think that to find new leadership moving into this is a high priority. And I think, too, that we will be certainly an attractive opening position for people across the country in these kind of positions.
Yeah, I agree that UNC once was really the crown jewel, sort of a shining light here in North Carolina that reflected upon us with its affordability and its high quality of education. And there were just so many things about UNC system that we were proud of. But I really do think that light has dimmed over the last decade. We've seen these massive disinvestments from the General Assembly. We've seen a 45% increase in tuition over the last decade. We've had this turmoil on the board ever since the firing of Tom Ross, really, and the sort of ideological hijacking of the Board of Directors, I think, or the Board of Governors. I think it's been really an unfortunate development. And then to add to that, just even though you've got a almost uniform conservative majority on the board, it's all, I think, 30 Republicans and maybe two independents, there's turmoil, there's backbiting. There was clearly a heavy level of tension between Smith and Roper. The reports from journalists who watched their press conference last week or their press availability after last week's Board of Governors meeting just reported that the two men were clearly at odds with each other. And that's just the latest in a series of events like that. We've got lots of lobbyists on the board. I think there's a lot of problems with the UNC Board of Governors. I don't have any particular confidence that things are going to get better. And I'm also not convinced that Roper still wouldn't like to have the job and that things could change, 6 months from now.
Yeah, well, Roper has said, he's going to resign as of June 1st, so I think that's out. So we're looking for, there will be a new chairman of the Board of Governors, there will be a new president of the system, and don't forget, too, we still have, I think it's three chancellorships at three of the universities that are empty, that we're also looking for that talent. So I see this as a great opportunity to move forward, bring in new leadership, new blood, really re-energize the whole system.
I'm optimistic. And though he denies it, there are persistent rumors that I have heard from multiple sources that House Speaker Tim Moore would like to be selected to be the next boss to take Roper's place. I think it would be a terrible decision. I think it would further politicize things, bringing in someone with really no particular education experience. But
well,
that rumor persists.
That's a rumor.
We have heard it from multiple members of the board.
It's a grenade. You just dropped a grenade right there, Rob. You're daring the reporter to touch the grenade. I got to at least acknowledge the grenade. So I'll say there's a grenade on the floor and perhaps the pin moves at some point soon. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, Moore has specifically denied this. Travis Fain reported for WRAO last month that he had asked Moore this question. And Moore, there's a lot of wiggle room in his statement. He says he's not pursuing it, doesn't want the job. But again, That's the safe position for people. It's a safe position for Roper to take if he might still harbor a desire to have the job. You publicly disavow any interest in it. But, if somebody came to you, you'd be interested. And I don't know why this rumor keeps cropping up with Speaker Moore. I hope it's not true. I don't mean to just be spreading rumors, but we have heard that from multiple sources over the last few months. And there's got to be a little fire there from that smoke.
I think there's going to be tremendous interest in this job. I don't know. It is a rumor that Tim Moore may be interested in it. Peter Hines, who is currently the president of the community college, is a name. I've heard, again, a rumor. Mm-hmm. But I would be surprised if there weren't lots of people across North Carolina who were interested in this position. And I think to dismiss people or start rumor mongering right now is a little premature.
All right. I'll offer a comment and a question to you, Becky, and then we'll move on to another topic. But the comment is in the conversations I've had as a reporter with a number of people is that there has not been widespread interest, that there aren't 30 or 40 or 100 people knocking down the door for the UNC system president. And as a reminder, there are also openings at Chapel Hill mm-hmm. chancellor and Greenville ECU chancellor. Right. And based on the conversations I've had with people who are far more well-versed in this than I am, that's surprising and concerning to them, that there isn't as healthy, as rich of a pool of candidates as they would have hoped for. My question for you, and I'll acknowledge the rumor now, but if there is a certain highest-ranking member of the North Carolina House, if Speaker Tim Moore does want this job, is there a conflict of interest to be presiding atop the House to have control over who some of these board members are while also pursuing this job. Is that a conflict of interest?
I think absolutely it's a conflict of interest if he's doing that at the same time. Mm-hmm. If he resigns as the speaker or if he pursues this after the election, you know, then no, of course not.
I think there's also a conflict of interest in the fact that we've got lobbyists on the board of directors, or board of governors, I'm sorry. I mean, I think, if I'm right, I think there are five registered lobbyists amongst the 32 board of governors members who then go and ask Tim Moore and Phil Berger for specific things for their clients that are unrelated to the university. I mean, it's – unfortunately, I think it's such a – it's become such a political body and not an academic body. And in fairness, Democrats did some of this as well. I think we would really be well served if we could move away from that and move in a direction where we're bringing in people who really were about education and not just politicians and certainly not just lobbyists.
On Monday, there were more theatrics here at the General Assembly. Continued finger-pointing following the surprise budget veto override vote earlier in the month. House Democratic leader Darren Jackson doubled down on his assertion that Republicans are lying about how this thing all played out. He dared the speaker, Tim Moore, among others, to take a lie detector test. The speaker responded by saying he would not, as this isn't the Maury Povich show. For the record, I am open to debating that claim later. Ultimately, the sparring offered little new concrete evidence. Rob, Republicans were getting understandably negative press on this whole thing. Did Representative Jackson actually hurt the narrative for Democrats?
I think that the die has already been cast there. I didn't think it was the best effort on his part. I mean, everybody knows that lie detectors are a silly machine that doesn't work anymore and has been proven. That's why they're not admissible in court. And, you know, I think he was trying to make a point, though, that he was personally outraged and he was trying somehow to convey that he was so upset about what happened and that he felt that he'd been lied to. The thing that I keep going back to this, though, is the fact that it doesn't matter who told who what when. The reality is that when Speaker Moore got up in the dais that day and looked out on the floor of the North Carolina House and saw there were 64 members present, it was the morally correct thing to do not to have a vote on the budget, the most important single vote that takes place in the General Assembly every session. It was just a bad act. Whether he told somebody or whether he hadn't told somebody, it didn't matter. He should have known it at that moment. It was the dishonorable and immoral thing to do.
I think that, you know, as you mentioned, there was no new concrete evidence. There was really nothing new in the theatrics on Monday. I'm not sure that it moved the ball forward for anybody. And I continue to be concerned about the acrimonious environment, particularly in the House. This session is not over. There's still things that may need to be addressed. You know, what are we going to do about the budget? Will we have more mini budgets that go forward? The Farm Act is still sitting out there. The governor vetoed the regulatory reform bill this week. There's some concerns of some things that he didn't mention in that regulatory reform bill that I think there's wide consensus for. The Medicaid transformation is another one. You know, there's still issues out there that it would be helpful from a public policy, good government, good North Carolina perspective for there to be some conversations and some consensus. And the longer this goes on and the more acrimonious it becomes, I'm concerned that nothing's going to happen. And not to, you know, just mention again, redistricting reform. And the further the parties pull apart or the stronger they go at each other, the less likelihood I think there is for consensus on some of these issues. And that concerns me because, you know, we're running out of time here. The next election cycle starts soon, 67 days, I think is what you said, Jeff, for the candidate filing. So, you know, it's time to wrap this session up, and there's still some important issues that I think need to be addressed. And my fear is, with all of this, it just won't get done because of the environment that we're stuck with.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think that we should have done this months ago. They should have sat down. Governor Cooper and the Republican leadership should have sat down and negotiated out. That's what the voters voted for last year when they ended the Republican supermajorities. They voted for a negotiated government, negotiated budget, and it stuns me continually that they will not sit down with Governor Cooper and actually sit down in a room and work this thing out.
Conversations, we have them each Friday at this time. Rob Schofield is director of NC Policy Watch. Becky Gray is senior vice president at the John Locke Foundation. Enjoy your weekend.
Have a great
Thanks,
weekend.
Thanks, guys.
Well down on my knee.
Our Week in Review conversation airs Friday at 4:50 on WUNC Radio. The longer conversations can be found wherever you download your podcasts. Weekend assignment for you. Tell a friend, colleague, or neighbor about this program.
For Becky and Rob, I'm Jeff. Look for our next podcast drop, a conversation about Medicaid, on Tuesday.
Have the Lord above my mercy. Please.